This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. America's national debt is soaring. $20 trillion as of a couple of months ago. Is this a problem? A lot of economists seem to think it isn't, but there is a lot of evidence showing that it is a problem, a major problem, a threat to national security. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about this. Last week, when America recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, many people said it would unleash a firestorm of Arab violence. Well, that didn't happen, and it's interesting to think about why that is the case in light of the Bible's prophecies. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall, who is over there in Jerusalem, about this important subject. Do you get enough sleep? If you're like most people, you're actually shortchanging yourself an hour or two every night. The effects on your mental and physical health are probably worse than you want to admit. We'll talk with personal trainer Jorg Mardian about the benefits of getting enough sleep, and we'll give you some strategies for how to do it. And I'll conclude the program today with a look at the unusual methods God can use to prepare someone for kingship. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. The United States national debt just passed $20 trillion this past September, and it seems like Americans have stopped being concerned about this. We've been racking up debt for decades. So far, it seems to be working out for us. Right now, there are a lot of positive signs in America's economy. The stock market's up, unemployment's down. Is there really a problem with national debt being so high? Well, Trumpet writer Andrew Miller says, yes, there is a problem. We have him here to talk about this. Hello, Andrew.
Hello.
So can you put the size of America's debt into perspective for us? $20 trillion, that's kind of hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, once you start getting up past a trillion, it is definitely hard to start figuring like, well, how much is this? So I've got a few metrics that maybe help some of our listeners visualize this. But basically, if you summed all the goods and services produced in the United States an entire year, $20 trillion is 5% more than that. Uh-huh. Or if you summed all the goods and service produced on planet Earth in a year, $20 trillion is roughly a fifth of that. If you were to print $20 trillion in $100 bill notes, that pile of money would weigh about 200,000 tons.
Whoa.
I think that's roughly the weight of your average skyscraper. Or wow. If you were to stack all those bills about 5 feet high on pallets, those pallets would cover roughly 20 football fields.
It's obviously a tremendous amount of money. It's exceeding our gross domestic product. You made mention of the fact this is 5% more than everything that the United States produces in a year. But there have been times, well, I guess it was during World War II when America's debt to GDP was actually higher than it is right now. Is that not true?
Right. If you adjust for inflation, the national debt at the end of World War II was getting close to $3 trillion. And now, granted, that's about a seventh of what the debt is right now. But because the economy was much smaller back then, as a ratio, that debt to gross domestic product ratio was getting up to about 113%,
okay,
which is about 8% higher,
yeah,
than it is right now.
So what's the problem then? If we're still less than what we were at the end of World War II, just proportionally?
Well, the problem is the trajectory. Obviously, in World War II, we were fighting a world war, and that was the primary reason the government was going into debt, or building tanks, paying soldiers, building planes, building ammunition, just had the entire economy in war mode. But that's the point with all wars is hopefully they end someday. And World War II did end, and when it ended, the government was able to slash government spending by more than half. Actually, they were able to slash by almost a third in 1948 is compared to what it was in 1945.
It was a third of what it had been during the war.
Right. Okay. 1945, last year of the war, they were able to slash the spending by a third of what that was as soon as the war stopped. And so they didn't actually pay off much of the debt they accrued during the war, but because they weren't going deeper into debt and the economy was growing, you eventually grew out of your debt. And within the next four decades, the debt to GDP ratio fell from 113% down to below 40%.
Uh-huh. And then, so you said four decades, that would have been somewhere in the 80s, things turned around.
It was about 80s when the debt started going up. That was actually
during the Reagan years.
Initially during the Reagan years, they had a strategy to defeat the Soviet Union. We'll actually probably end up talking about that a little later in this interview. But he figured that if we could bait the Soviet Union into an arms race, our capitalist economy will handle the debt better than their socialist economy, and we'll drive them to bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And so that's when the debt started going up. And initially through the 80s, it was mostly arms spending. Today, that's not actually the case. The only sectors of the government spending that are growing faster than the economy is are healthcare and Social Security.
Yeah,
those are the ones that keep taking up an increasing portion of our gross domestic product. And that's why this is so much different than World War II, is that while we were expecting World War II to end, we're not expecting healthcare or retirement to get cheaper anytime soon.
Right. These are entitlement programs that just keep on getting bigger.
Right. The Congressional Budget Office would estimate that within three decades, our debt will almost quadruple up to like $92 trillion.
Yeah. So we're talking about the paying for these programs, Social Security, healthcare, with borrowed money. Where are we getting the money? How much of this is foreign-owned, or does it even matter?
Right. Well, about a third of the debt is foreign-owned. The rest we own to either individual Americans who've bought Treasury bonds or the Federal Reserve. So that's about $5.6 trillion that's foreign-owned. The biggest foreign creditor is still China, who owns about $1.2 trillion. Japan comes in a really close second, about $1.1 trillion. And then there's a number of other nations, Brazil, Ireland, the Cayman Islands, that make up the other three or so trillion.
Yeah.
But that's as far as does it matter, there's two main differences between foreign debt that makes it a little more concerning than domestic debt or debt you own to the Federal Reserve or to American citizens. The first is that obviously the interest on a foreign debt is giving money to nations that are potential rivals. I think we spend roughly $27 billion a year in interest payments to China.
Uh-huh.
So that's about like 12% of China's entire defense budget. And
right.
So when you're looking at China militarizing trade routes in the South China Sea, I mean, you could reckon it that a lot of that money is actually being underwritten by American taxpayers, as
yeah.
we keep funneling 12% of their military budget to them each year in defense and interest payments.
Okay, so what do you say to the people who, the economists who argue that when other countries invest in the United States, that's a good thing? You know, when someone deposits $1 million into the bank, well, technically that bank is $1 million in debt. But that's not bad. It's going to use that $1 million to make even more money. And the fact that you have all these countries and all of these Americans, all of these different investors that are basically showing their confidence in the American system by investing in it, it just shows how strong that investment is, doesn't it?
Right. And I guess there's different types of investment. I mean, there is actually like you can have foreign companies that invest in an American company, which is a little different from them buying a treasury bond, because when they buy the treasury bond, then it's up to the U.S. government to decide what to do with the money they borrowed.
Yeah.
And as with any investment, there's good investments and there's bad investments. I guess just to use bring this down to like an individual level, like if someone went out, let's say I went out and got a master's degree in petroleum engineering, I'm going to go pretty deep into debt getting that, or could go pretty deep into debt getting that. But that's one of the degree that I'm probably, my earning potential is going to be so much when I get out of college that I'll come out ahead financially in the long run.
Yeah.
Now, if I went deep into debt, getting a degree in, say, gender studies, I might be in a financially tight spot depending on what Taco Bell's paying that year. But
so, in other words, what are we using the money for? If the government is basically paying out all of these treasuries, lending all of this money to these foreign countries, or these foreign countries lending to the United States, and the United States government is spending that on paying out entitlements.
Right. That's actually another, I guess, back to the World War II example, is you can even, in a strange way, argue that the debt during World War II helped the nation, because even though it was a very high ratio, we were spending it on modernizing industry, building tanks, building planes, things that were able to be turned into peacetime production for cars and other things after. So we had
not to mention saving the world.
Right. And not to mention saving the world. But beyond just that is that when you got to the end, you actually had a modernized industry that you could actually use to make money. And there was a huge economic boom after mm-hmm. World War II that really helped them outgrow their debt. To where now, like I said, if you're giving this out in Social Security payments or health care payments, I mean, we have the data that that's not growing the economy faster than it's growing the debt. Those two programs in particular, they're taking up increasing portions of GDP without growing the economy at a faster rate, and that's why the debt keeps increasing.
Yeah. So the United States is not the first country in history to be deeply in debt. When you look at history, what kind of lessons can you take from the position that America finds itself in now?
Right. Well, recent history, I mean, you can definitely look to nations like Greece or Italy or a lot of these things in the Euro crisis. These are also nations that have a very high debt to GDP ratio based off entitlement spending. A little further along, their debts are smaller than the U.S. debt because they're smaller nations, but the debt to GDP ratio is higher, and they're begging for bailouts now. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, probably the closest example to a superpower that's actually fallen due to debt problems is the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah.
And we mentioned that that was kind of part of President Ronald Reagan's strategy to bait them into an arms race that he knew their economy wasn't in a position to handle to increase their debt. But by 1989, Gorbachev was pretty much going hat in hand, trying to like open up his perestroika, soften down on some of his old Soviet problems, basically in turn try to get Western nations to give him money that he needed to run the economy. Uh-huh. But it was too late by the point that times like Poland and Germany, East Germany and Czechoslovakia started rebelling against the Soviet Union. They didn't have the money to pay for the military hardware it would have taken to force them to stay in. And they knew it. Poland knew that if they rebelled, there's nothing the Kremlin can do about it. They're broke.
So looking at this from you actually say that the national security is threatened by the national debt, and you're looking at Bible prophecy to underpin that. There's obviously data and there is evidence that you can look at that isn't prophetic, but maybe you can just summarize why we should be concerned about our security because of our debt issues.
Right, and that's the biggest security problem is the interest payments, the out-of-control interest payments. Right now, we spend roughly $250 billion a year in interest. But, as I said, if the debt balloons out to $92 trillion in the next three decades, even at the currently low interest rates, we'll be spending $800 billion a year in interest. Or if the interest rates go up, it could be over $1 trillion a year in interest. And that's something that there's a financial historian, Niall Ferguson, really points out, is that historically looking at like the Soviet Union or even the Roman Empire, a lot of nations and empires fall apart when their interest payments become more than their defense budget. In the fact that you can't, the U.S. tries to keep world peace with 800 military bases spread out across the globe, and they're spending $600 billion a year on defense. But once you start getting to the point where you have to spend $800 billion just on interest, you don't have the money for those bases anymore, and you have to start slashing your defense budget because all your money's going towards giving interest payments to countries like China and Japan and whatever domestic holders you have.
Well, that sounds, we're a ways off from that though, then. If we're talking about, we're $250 billion a year in interest payments now and we're $600 billion in defense spending, if that's the threshold that we're concerned about, then we've got a little bit of play here, don't we?
Right. Well, according to the 2017 long-term projection, budget projection that Congress put out, we've got about 5 years before the interest payments pass the defense budget.
Oh, wow.
And so it goes up quicker than you'd think. But right now they're saying it's going to go from $250 billion up to past $600 billion just in 5 years. And that's assuming we're spending like 1.25% interest rates,
right,
which are historically, I didn't check to see if it's a record, but if it's not a record, it's really close to record low interest rates.
And it's been that way for quite some time. And there are people who are concerned that just the way that the American economy is traveling right now, that it's actually going to bump inflation and interest rates up at some point, maybe sooner than people would think.
Right. If those interest rates went up in the next couple of years, I mean, it could, well, depending on what the rate was, you could be spending more on interest than on defense in 12 months.
Yeah.
But if it stays where it is, it's about 5 years.
So looking at this prophetically, what do you take from it? What lessons do you take?
Well, just speaking more in general terms, I mean, King Solomon had written in Proverbs 22, verse 7, that the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. And being a servant isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessarily a thing that all debt is bad. But if you're going to go into debt to someone, you are indebted to them. You're kind of in a servant-like position, and you want to be very careful about who your master is. Because earlier in the Bible, in Deuteronomy, actually, I think this is in Deuteronomy 5, verses 5 and 6, God actually made a specific promise to the Israelites. He said, if you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you, for the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and you shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. And it's saying this is like a promise to Israel. That's like, if you follow my laws, it says that you are going to be the lender. Mm-hmm. And like Solomon said, the nations that have lent from you will be your servants.
Yeah, and it links the that aspect, of the financial aspect, with the rulership aspect. It's a matter of being ruled or ruling.
Right. You are the ruling nation because you're the biggest creditor nation. And then a little further on in the chapter in Deuteronomy 28, that's one of the blessings and curses chapters in the Bible, it reiterates that same promise we just read in Deuteronomy 5, but it adds to it saying that if you disobey God's laws, then the sojourner who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He will lend to you, and you will not lend to him. And then he will be the head, and you will be the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are general scriptures that would apply, just laws of finance that would apply to any nation. But they're also specific prophecies about Israel in the end time. Yeah. And it says that in the end time, Israel would be the greatest of all the creditor nations. But then when they turn away from God, they quickly become the greatest of all the debtor nations. And there's other prophecies that indicate that as that debt builds up and they become the greatest debtor nations, they lose their financial superpowers, if you will, to the point where they can't even militarily defend all the trade routes and sea gates around the world. That's another prophecy about Israel in the end time, that they'd control all the sea gates, gates like the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal and the Straits of Gibraltar. And when they can't defend those anymore, their enemies take them. And now, if your enemies have all the sea gates, they have power enough to enforce a trade embargo. And it's really kind of that trade embargo that's like the beginning of the end. They have to become a debtor nation that can't defend the sea gates anymore. But once they don't have those sea gates, then just from a trade standpoint, you're very vulnerable. And that's also a great proof for any of our listeners who don't know where the end time descendants of ancient Israel are, is that if you've proven we're in the end time, you just need to figure out, who was the greatest creditor nation that is now becoming the greatest debtor nation, who used to control all the sea gates and now is losing them all.
Yeah.
It's pretty specific that you can, if you didn't know anything about ancient history and tribal migrations and where nations went to, just if you know you're in the end time, who's the biggest creditor, who's becoming the biggest debtor, who has all the sea gates, who's losing all those sea gates.
Right.
And whoever that is,
that's got to be the descendants,
the end time
of,
descendants of Israel.
So you can read more about that in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. We'll also put some links to some other relevant material on the show notes to this program. You can find that on thetrumpet.com. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about America's national debt posing a national security threat. He's got a video that is posted to thetrumpet.com on the issue. The national debt is a domestic security threat. You can find that on thetrumpet.com as well. Thanks for your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Last week, America recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and leaders and media commentators the world over were predicting a violent response from the Arabs. Last Friday, the old city of Jerusalem was full of television cameras, gearing up to record the clashes that were going to fill the streets as Arabs went to and from their prayers on Friday. But it didn't happen. The violence never materialized. The Arabs apparently didn't think Donald Trump's announcement was anything worth bothering over. Why not? What can we learn from this? The answers to those questions actually give some important insight into what we can expect in Jerusalem in the time ahead. To talk about this, we have from our office in Jerusalem, trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
Why did the media get this so wrong?
Yeah, it is interesting. It's not just the media. It's commentators from over around the world, world leaders, in fact, European leaders. We've talked about how up in arms they were about this, many of them declaring at how this was going to bring on another intifada, another uprising, a Palestinian uprising, and it was going to cause a lot of casualties of Jews, and it was going to cause a lot of casualties for the Palestinians as well. But it just didn't materialize.
And I have to say that I'd have to put ourselves in that category too, or we certainly thought that it could create quite a bit of problems. And in some ways I was thinking, it's kind of admirable that the American president had the courage to go ahead and do it in spite of the threat of these things breaking down. So it wasn't only those other folks. We thought that could be an issue as well. So now we're just trying to figure out what happened here.
Right. Yeah. In a way, yes. I would say that most people in Jerusalem, Palestinian or Israeli didn't really think it was going to materialize too much, just because, well, at least the decision, because we're so used to Israel being having its capital in Jerusalem, the Arabs as well in East Jerusalem. My apartment building is having work done right now on it. It's in West Jerusalem every single morning at about 5:45, a van full of Arabs. They're the construction workers. They came to work. So it wasn't, we weren't really expecting too much. We were probably expecting more than happened. So I don't want to paint it out that we called this. But definitely it seems that the Palestinians weren't mobilized like most thought they would be. And really dissecting that, this question of why is important, especially as we can contrast it to what took place about 6 months ago, right, when we did have mass riots throughout Jerusalem, and we did have people taking to the streets for a series of about 2 weeks. We had huge riots taking place, and people would have, you might have thought that setting up a couple of metal detectors at right, the entrance to the Temple Mount, which was the cause of those riots back in July and early August, that was less of a event than the Americans finally recognizing Jerusalem as the capital. But not so, according to the Palestinians. They were ready to come out on the streets in mass, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, for the previous event, but not this one last week.
Yeah, so that is an interesting way of looking at that, just contrasting the response to the metal detectors and this sense that, you know, we were talking at the time about this libel, basically this lie that the Jews are trying to take over the Temple Mount and, you know, the status quo is going to be disrupted and they've been trying to do this. Here you have basically a foreign leader making what amounts to essentially a political decision. Is that the difference?
Yeah, it very much is. What we've seen is that first decision was a decision based on religious grounds. They decided to mobilize because they thought that their religious actions were in jeopardy. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. And they saw the Temple Mount metal detectors being set up as a move by Israel to stop them from being able to worship, whereas this decision was purely a political one, saying that we're going to call this the capital of Israel from now on, the Americans, and this, other commentators were saying, jeopardize the peace talks because the Jerusalem status is meant to be decided by the two parties. And the Palestinians, if they cared, or if they bought into that idea that the Western media was trying to push, that this did jeopardize the future negotiations, maybe they would have decided to react. But there's a couple things we can see here. Maybe they don't think this jeopardizes those peace talks, or maybe they care less about Palestinian statehood as the ends in itself than what the Western media would like to say. And I think what we can see through this is, if you're just looking at this as far as how would you get the Palestinians themselves to mobilize en masse, they will do it for religious reasons, but they won't do it for national reasons.
Okay, so just thinking about this in terms of Bible prophecy, because we there are very specific Bible prophecies that we look at that describe what's going to be happening in that city. How does, say, you're talking about what is actually going to motivate the Palestinians, the Arabs, to violent action? How does that factor in with what we're expecting to see in that city?
Yeah, this is why we're focusing on this and taking these points away from what's happened, contrasting these two incidents and the response from them. It's because biblical prophecy in the book of Zechariah, chapter 14 and verse 1 and 2, it goes through a series of three events that lead, the final one being the return of Christ. And the first event, they're kind of like a series of events, one leads into another. The very first one in verse 2 there talks about half of Jerusalem being taken. And we're looking for this event. Obviously, right now we have the Arabs in mainly East Jerusalem and the Jews mainly in West Jerusalem. Yet the Jews are pretty much in control of the whole area. We expect the Arabs actually to take full control over East Jerusalem. But what's interesting about that prophecy is it indicates that it is a violent takeover. It's not the result of some type of peace negotiation where the Arabs get East Jerusalem. So we're trying to think about what is the event that is going to make the Arabs take to arms. It is not going to be just a negotiation back and forth or some type of political thing, unless it revolves around the sacred turf of the Temple Mount or the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that's what we've seen, whether it's the First Intifada, Second Intifada, the Knife Intifada, or that's the Temple Mount impasse we had over the metal detectors. Palestinians came out on the streets over what they saw as Israelis denying them access to their place of worship. And so that's what we expect to happen again. Our editor-in-chief has written a lot in both his book on Jerusalem and Prophecy and also his book on the on Zechariah itself. He's talked about how the Temple Mount is kind of like the very focal point of Jerusalem. Everybody's looking at Jerusalem around the world, reporting on Jerusalem. But then if you shrink Jerusalem down, where is the most sacred turf? It is the Temple Mount. It is claimed by the Jews as their the location of their holiest site. It's claimed by the Arabs as the location of their third holiest site, and neither side is willing to give that up. And so we are expecting to see, in order for half of Jerusalem to fall because of an uprising of the Palestinians, that uprising to have to concern the Temple Mount itself.
So right now, all of the discussion is, does this hurt or help peace process efforts, this announcement by the United States to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital? Most people say this hurts it. The Trump administration insists that it helps it. Looked at from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, what do you make of it?
Well, it's when you consider the fact that, as I was saying, this is more than just a nationalist agenda. This is more than just having one state for Palestinians, one state for the Jews living next to each other, and they'll work it out. Because it really gets down to where you draw the line. Where you draw the line through Jerusalem, that's why Jerusalem is the kicker that nobody can decide or that everybody believes is going to be the most difficult thing to overcome to bring peace. People will say, well, we have some land swaps. Israel will take some land. The Palestinians will take some land. Okay, well, that's all good and well when you're outside of Jerusalem. What happens when you're drawing the line through Jerusalem? Who gets the Temple Mount? Who gets the Temple Mount? The Jews won't be willing to part with it, and the Arabs will always fight unless they control it fully. And so this really is indicative of the fact that the peace process it's impossible in our day and age for it to be solved just because of both sides not willing and not able to give up on the Temple Mount.
Well, let's just bring Iran into the equation here, because this is obviously they've had designs on Jerusalem. We've talked about just the fact that this is really kind of the jewel in their plan for the Middle East. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, talked about that. As they're strategizing and they're trying to think, how can we actually take that area over? How does, say, America's decision factor into that? And what are they calculating as they're watching this?
It really is interesting looking at Iran, because they have been focused on Jerusalem for some time now. They have their Quds force, one of their crack team of fighters that they send all over the world. It's named the Jerusalem Force because that is their goal. And what we've seen, the rhetoric coming out of Tehran has always been not just supporting the Palestinian struggle, it's been supporting the Palestinians so that they can finally control Al-Aqsa, to try and boot the Jewish filthy feet, as they call them, off the Temple Mount so that they can control that. And so this can actually be a unifying force. Trump's decision can be a unifying force for the Iranians behind the common goal, if they of Jerusalem, if they can paint it in a way that he is threatening the Al-Aqsa. He is threatening Al-Quds, as they call it. Then he can actually, or the regime can actually mobilize different radical Islamists behind their cause. This is not just me talking. This was written in one of their newspapers of the IRGC this week. They said, quote, this is, again, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps paper. They said, this situation in reality, speaking of Trump's decision, under these conditions makes Iran's work in forming a resistance front with a focus on defending Palestine easier. They're looking at this decision from Mr. Trump saying, thank you. We need the Arab world, the Muslim world, to unite behind us to try and eventually take Jerusalem. That is what they want to do. And you've just made it easier, Mr. Trump, by making the Muslim world feel like, or at least the radicals, feel like you're making a play for Jerusalem. It's going to be easier for us to control, at least to garner more support for their long-term goal.
Well, I guess we'll see what kind of success they have in enacting that policy. You said that you are working on an article on the subject. Anything that you might direct people to if they wanted to, more information about this, short of reading that article?
Yeah, I would read Chapter 3 of Jerusalem in Prophecy. It's entitled Jerusalem About to Explode. It goes through this prophecy in the book of Zechariah, Chapter 14, in detail. And it shows why we're so concerned about these riots or non-riots in the Holy City.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall about the Arab and the Iranian response to America's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. You can also find Jerusalem in Prophecy on thetrumpet.com under the Literature tab or in the show notes for this Trumpet Hour episode. We appreciate your time, Brent.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Do you get enough sleep? A lot of us don't. It should make up about one-third of our life. It's clearly important. It has an amazing amount of recuperative powers for the body and the mind. It improves mental clarity, productivity, physical performance, emotional balance. It can even help prevent weight gain. There are so many good benefits from sleep, but why do we resist? Why do we have so much trouble getting to bed and getting enough sleep? To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia, personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hi.
It's good to have you. So how much sleep should we get each night, and how much do people actually get?
Well, that's a good question. The experts across the board say we should get about 7 to 9 hours a night. And that's just what they say is the sweet spot to remain engaged and alert during the workday. But amazingly, most people ignore that despite the advice being out there. And they say most people are about an hour or two underneath that. So a lot of people are getting by with 5 or 6 hours a night. And, you know, if you've endured, and we all have, it's a fairly common occurrence, if you've endured a night without sleep, you know that functioning through the next day can be pretty uncomfortable and frustrating.
Yeah.
So, there's statistics showing that since the invention of the light bulb, people sleep about 500 hours less a year.
Wow.
That's a lot.
So the light bulbs are keeping us up. When you don't have that on-off switch, then, which you kind of find that if you ever go camping or, you know, you're outside, once the sun goes down, you kind of lose your motivation to stay up.
That's right. It has to do with the light. Light keeps us awake. But as soon as it turns dark, then the brain chemicals start to flow. Now, what we do in the modern times, and this is a modern occurrence, actually, we've got all these electronic devices. So our house is lit up. It can be lit up night and day. It doesn't matter. You can be at 4 in the morning and you've got light. And that fools the eyes. We've also got electronic devices, smartphones and tablets and TVs, and they emit what's called a blue light. Mm-hmm. And that blue light actually keeps us fairly awake. So, you know, we get to a state where we're just fumbling in the dark. I mean, we're just groggy all the time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the benefits of sleep, why it's so important that we get the recommended amount.
Sure. There's a lot of benefits. I mean, the first one, as with a lot of things, is brain health, because the brain is just so tightly involved in the biological processes of sleep. It still fools a lot of scientists. They don't really understand all the ins and outs, but they do say that when we sleep, it takes the jumbled pieces of the day's information, and it kind of reorganizes it, like in a drawer or a file folder at night. And so that prevents from running out of space to store new memories. Hmm. So that, they believe, is pretty solid, the science there. And it does that by actually shrinking the cells of the brain by 60%. And that causes waste removal in a regimented way. It's pretty fascinating.
Your brain cells shrink when you're sleeping?
That's what I was reading on it. I never knew that. But there's so much coming out now in the last even decade on research on this that scientists are pretty certain on certain things of how sleep affects you. And the brain is just one of the key components of that. I mean, basically, in the simplest way, when we're awake, we use and burn. And when we sleep, we restore and synthesize. Hmm. So if we don't, we'll keep going on the benefits. There's also, for the body, there's a lot of benefits for recuperation, keeping disease away. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a pro and a con. If we sleep good, I mean, it may sound like something you say, well, you know what, like it sounds good, but how do I really know? Well, if you don't sleep a lot, then you're going to have those wider implications on health. You know, like, let's say older adults, the statistics show that less than 6 hours a night, you're 200% more likely to have a heart attack or stroke than sleeping 7 or 8 hours a night. I mean, that's just an amazing statistics. And, you know, as well, so heart attacks and strokes. And they say if you don't get enough sleep as well, you're predicted to only live to your early 60s without medical intervention. So the body really starts to break down. I mean, that's what they're saying with the medical intervention, because that's the way that they look at it. But still, it shows that there's a massive breakdown. And the same with kids. Kids get very hyperactive when they don't sleep enough. They get inattentive and impulsive. So it's somewhat the same as a lot of sugar in the diet. Hmm. You know, and so instead of looking at a lack of sleep, they might look at it as just being, you know, having a problem with that child, instead of looking at the base cause of that. What's the home life like? Are you sleeping enough, and are you eating good enough?
Yeah. I do. I imagine that we can all identify with that to some degree, that your body doesn't feel good. Your mind isn't working the way that it should if you're sleep deprived. I remember looking into this subject somewhat in depth some years ago, and what really struck me, it was when I was reading the Gulag Archipelago of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and he was talking about the techniques that the Soviet police would use on people when they would arrest them in order to break them down and to get them to confess to crimes that they hadn't committed and that type of thing. The number one tool that they used was sleep deprivation. Basically, it would reduce the most stalwart, strong individual to putty in their hands within a matter of 24 to 48 hours if they, you know, did whatever they could to deprive them of being able to fall asleep. They just no longer had the ability to resist whatever tactics that they would use on them. And I thought, you know, in a certain sense, you can kind of experience that. You sense that decline in productivity, and just generally you're not operating at an optimal level. But people can, I guess you can kind of convince yourself that you'll get by just fine. Maybe take the second cup of coffee or whatever you might need to do to get through the day.
Absolutely. And that's why coffee is so popular today. I mean, it's the number one drink in the world. Sleep helps to preserve all necessary functions of the body in various ways. Now, you know, just getting back on sleep deprivation, so far there's no human death attributed to absolute sleep deprivation. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but that's not the case with animals. So just, you know, getting back on the importance of sleep, because we tend not to look at sleep as something that's in a case where, you know, I need this as much as I need eating or breathing.
Mm-hmm.
You do. So they showed that rats will die in 2 to 3 weeks with absolute lack of sleep. So animals operate on the same functions, basic functions as we do, you know, so how long would a human last? Well, we haven't done those studies because ethically we can't do them.
Right. No, I think I would die if I went without sleep for 2 or 3 weeks. That doesn't seem that out of the question. So just getting to some of the specifics, sleep deprivation, what does that do to brain health, for example?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, as we continue the habit of not sleeping enough, it causes psychological damage because the sleep, it regulates brain hormones. And interestingly enough, sleep loss and depression tend to intertwine the symptoms. So because the chemical changes in the brain, so it results in manic feelings if you're not sleeping enough, and behavior that's similar to bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get highs of ecstasy and you're going to get lows of depression and anger if you continue this habit of not sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And then the side effects are hallucinations. And that's been proven with people trying to stay awake for longer periods of time. Psychosis, long-term memory impairment. There's a scientist that did quite a study when he was a doctor. And he said he went 36 weeks. He had to work every other night. And he says he experienced all of that. He was talking to himself.
Mm.
He was babbling about things that no one knew what he was, you know, what he was talking about. And he says now his memory is not the same. And this is a doctor.
That's
so the
amazing.
Brain suffers a lot.
So the implication being that there was actually permanent damage from that.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is why I would caution people myself, as I was talking to you earlier, being a businessman, being in business, you push because you have to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not wise. And you can do that for years, and you can actually tell yourself, look, everything's fine because I'm functioning.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting experiment, which I just found out being looking at it and saying, look, I need more sleep, and just upping it by an hour, hour and a half a night. And the result with my clients is amazing. They think they have a different person in front of them. Now I get, wow, you've got jokes. My jokes are actually jokes now.
So better sleep actually improves your sense of humor. That's phenomenal. I don't even think you would find that on most lists of the advantages of enough sleep.
One person's opinion, of course.
So obviously, if we're generally people are going around sleep deprived, you're talking about major effects on society in lost productivity, healthcare, all of these types of things. Do you have any sense of, like, is that quantifiable?
Oh, there's statistics out there. Say the U.S. economy, they say there's about $16 billion in healthcare costs just with lack of sleep and the various diseases that you can get. Look at driver fatigue. Sleep deprivation is one of the things that really affects motor skills.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, one of the statistics says that disrupted reaction times and concentration with drivers leads to a staggering 168% increased risk of crashing your car.
Wow.
And a 460% risk of a near miss. So annually that adds up to roughly 100,000 car accidents and some 1,500 deaths a year.
Mm.
Now, it gets a little bit worse with work liability, because there's some pretty big accidents, historic accidents over the years that are attributed to rundown managers to CEOs, such as the Exxon Valdez, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, even the Challenger shuttle explosion. They say part of that, the part of the error process was fatigued people working on those 30-hour shifts and just not making those critical decisions.
That's amazing. So we don't have a whole lot of time left. I'd like to get to some solutions. And I will say this, that I've talked to a lot of people who, even if they might recognize the benefits of sleep, but maybe they struggle to even get to sleep. There are a lot of people who have trouble falling asleep at night, or maybe they'll wake up in the middle of the night and they can't get back to sleep. Maybe you could just talk about how to build right sleep habits and just help the person who's struggling with that.
Sure. One of the ways that I found for myself is just to put a greater value on sleep. Mm-hmm. I just did not put the value on it, even though I knew I'm in the health field and I know sleep is good for me, but you know, you can deceive yourself easily. So one of the best ways to catch up is to get yourself in a consistent habit. Mm-hmm. So give yourself a non-negotiable 7 to 8 hours sleep time, and then perhaps actually set an alarm at night to start cycling down a half hour before bedtime. Mm-hmm. You know, make it important. As soon as that alarm goes off, just like in the morning, we start reacting to it. Then shut off the electronic devices, anything that can keep you awake, and then read a book to produce some sleepiness. You know, a lot of it has to do with us wanting to do it and then getting into a consistent habit, because our quality of life depends on it.
Yeah. Anywhere that you might send someone who wants more information on the subject?
I don't have any sites offhand here, but I can, the article that I have coming out on it, it'll have some information on it.
Yeah. So we've been talking about the importance of sleep with personal trainer Jörg Mardian, and he's writing an article on the subject for thetrumpet.com. At this point, you said that the title of it is Sleepocalypse.
Sleepocalypse, Surviving the Red Eye Express.
So we'll see if that makes it all the way to the front page of thetrumpet.com. But there definitely does seem to be somewhat of a sleepocalypse going on. A lot of people failing to get the right amount and suffering all kinds of health and related problems as a result of that. But we appreciate you bringing that to our attention, Jörg, and we look forward to reading the article.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Some people dream of becoming royalty. A young girl wants to be a princess, or a child thinks of becoming a king or a queen. It's the stuff of fairy tales. But it's a lot more than that. If you look in the Bible, God actually says that he's making his people spiritual royalty. He calls the members of his church a royal priesthood. He says that they're kings and priests. Even their children are called princes in all the earth. He promises to give us a crown. He says we're going to sit on thrones, ruling under the King of Kings, Jesus Christ. Now, how does God train someone for royalty? You might think of formal dinners where you learn how to sip soup from the correct spoon and properly butter your dinner roll, or you learn how to wave properly, or how to enjoy classical music or fine art. All of these things have their place, but God's royal training isn't just a life of fancy dinners and opulent palace affairs. If you want proof, just look at King David. How did God prepare this man for kingship? Look at the history and you see just how difficult training for a godly royal position can be. David received his call to greatness as a youth. He was actually anointed king while he was still a teenager, even though he didn't actually assume royal authority until much later, 17 years later, in fact. You follow David's life from that point, and you see how God trained him. Under God's direction, David honed his talents. He progressed as a musician and a poet. He developed his work ethic and his skill as a shepherd. He grew in courage and wisdom. And above all, he prioritized building his relationship with God. These are all vital aspects of royal training. A major part of David's royal training, though, was something most people would not expect. God made David live as a fugitive and an outlaw for years. Israel's incumbent king, Saul, became jealous of David and tried to kill him. David had to flee for his life. You can read about this in Gerald Fleury's book, The Former Prophets, How to Become a King. He wrote, it's interesting that a big part of David's training for his role as king was running from Saul. Now read Psalm 142 in the Bible, which David wrote while he was hiding from Saul's guards in a cave. He said, my spirit was overwhelmed within me. In the way in which I walk, they have secretly set a snare for me. Refuge has failed me. No one cares for my soul. I'm brought very low. Clearly, David struggled to understand why this was happening as these anxious hours passed within that dark, inhospitable, rocky shelter. Surely he was thinking, wow, when I was anointed king, I never expected this. How could such an ordeal possibly be training for kingship? Mr. Fleury answers, spiritually, David was being fitted for his calling by learning how to depend on God constantly. He was sorely tested before he became king. God was preparing him to rule. Now, think of the challenges and the problems and the trials that you face in your life. Is God putting you through similar training? You may not face life-threatening situations, but difficulties, obstacles, occasional hardships, these befall all of us. And when those things arise, don't get frustrated or discouraged or bitter or angry about them. Recognize them as part of royal preparation. This Psalm 142 shows how David really was learning that invaluable lesson of how to depend on God. He wrote, I cried unto the Eternal with my voice. I poured out my complaint before him. I showed before him my trouble. Now, that's a marvelous thing to do. If you feel overwhelmed, do what David did. Just pour it all out to God. Tell him everything. That is a very royal thing to do. Just imagine this young man hiding in a cave in the wilderness out of fear of being murdered by the king of the land. He's having to hunt for food every day just to survive. And what else was he doing with his time in those dangerous, trying, uncomfortable conditions? He was composing Psalm 142. He was writing poetry to God. That is the attitude of a godly royal. If you ever find yourself in that proverbial cave, some overwhelming challenge or trial, remember, this is royal training. You are following in the difficult footsteps of David on the path toward kingship. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Andrew Miller, Brent Noctegal, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Theodore Roosevelt. It's only through labor and prayerful effort, by grim energy and resolute courage, that we move on to better things. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.